Okay, so let's get going. Hi, I'm Reinhard, and welcome to Why You Want to Use Arch Linux. So today I'm here to highlight why I think that you, maybe some of you, might want to use Arch Linux yourself. Maybe after the talk, some of you might even wish you would have used it yesterday already. So before we hop into the details, the slides are online right now, so you can, if you want to check out the details, you can follow. There is a nice shortcut that a friend of mine who is also in the audience today provided, or the long version. The short version is here too, if you are not quick enough in typing it. I hope it's readable also from the back rows. And before we hop into the details of Arch Linux, a couple of words about myself and what I want to do today, what my mission is. So, who am I? I'm Reinhard, as I said. I am an Hagenberg / JKU alumni myself. I finished mobile computing here 2011 and 2013. And I got my doctorate from JKU in 2017. Currently, I'm a postdoctoral researcher in Finland at the Aalto University. And I'm only here for winter teaching because I'm an external lecturer here at the university as well. And there I do winter courses, some of you know because they are sitting in my courses, and others have the master's thesis supervised by me. So that's what I do here. And I consider myself to be like a geek, curious, full of energy, and I love it. And those people that know me, they also know that usually. So you really can't avoid that if you know me. What do I do in tech myself? You kind of see some of these big keywords here. I have to deal with like machine learning things, signal processing, you know, intelligence, recognition stuff, biometrics, combinatorial puzzle games, all of that stuff. And in all of it, I use Arch Linux as my operating system. So this is kind of like what I do all of these things on. And with that, what is my goal for today? I have like these three key points. That's my mission. I want you to understand why you might want to use Arch Linux yourself. So when it might be like a good choice as operating system for what you do. Arch is said to be like super complex. So I want to take a little of that fear away because it's really not as complex as it might look like. And in the end, I also would want you to have some core ideas about these concepts that Arch has, for example, like rolling release system, Pacman, software repositories, etc. And how we're gonna organize that today, so how am I gonna get you there? Actually, we have two parts. We have the why Arch part, which is like my or your story with Linux. And the second one is like all these superfluous details that are interesting because actually you need them, but you don't need to talk about them. Because in Arch Linux, RTFM really works. And we're gonna see that. So I kinda have things here like some top level architecture about the Arch installation and post installation steps, some details that matter, Pacman, etc., and some Q&A in the end about all that I know or don't know. There are Arch users in the audience too. So we can always also ask the audience about stuff that I don't know or Google. Okay, so let's get going. Part one, why Arch? My story with Linux, which maybe or hopefully also could be your story with Linux. So I kind of tell you that so that you can maybe connect to what you see here. If you connect to it, then maybe Arch Linux is the Linux for you. Disclaimer, parts of that stuff might look like a rant. Please keep that in mind. I'm not ranting around here. I just honestly point out what my experience with Linux has been over the years. And for pointing out that I like something about Arch and my journey, I also at some point need to point out why I disliked other things, right? So that's not a rant, that's just my honest experience. So let's start the journey. Let's go back in time. Once upon a time, there was a kid that went to a HTL, like secondary technical college, right? That was a gamer kid, that was me. I was gaming a lot, right? So you guess what the operating system for that is? It's not Linux, it's Windows. And I mean, you know, it works fine. And towards the end of my secondary technical college, I, as so many others, tried Linux because, you know, it's around, people say it's kind of cool, but you can't play stuff on it. So I kind of bumped into this. We had some Mac users at the time in my class. They kind of invested twice the amount of money, had super awesome hardware. Don't get me wrong, not a rant, right? But we also, like, you know, they were a little cute because you can't do everything. In Windows, it's like, yeah, you can do pretty much, but sometimes it breaks down and you get all these viruses and you can game. Awesome. And yeah, that the Linux, nobody really used it, but once you try it, you're like, oh wow, yeah, that is powerful. You kind of try it, you like it, you lick blood. And gaming wins. Right? I mean, you go back because it's like, yeah, it's awesome, I kind of broke my PC, I want to actually play whatever. Windows, let's go. So I did that until the end of my secondary technical college. Maybe that's already something that some of you might have seen or not have seen themselves. You tried, you're like, oh, that's difficult, I want to game Windows. So what happened then? I mean, you know, you kind of finish your education, then there is that awesome time where some boredom might happen. Right? I mean, take a minute to see that. That this is kind of like, if you're on that level of boredom, then you have time again for trying stuff. Right? So I tried Linux again during that time. By the way, just to point that out, actually the guy is breaking that shield law stuff. Right? Because there is grass. It's just below his leg. You have to spot it. Right? So if you're like on that level of boredom, then you're like, yes, I have time for Linux again. So you try it. You can break it, you can rebuild it, because it's not running away, you have so much time. However, I didn't really use it as an operating system for my daily business, because my daily business was, as you see, that boredom in the picture, right? So, didn't really happen so much until I started studying. I mean, I started studying here. And we had an awesome Linux course in the first semester, I think. And I decided at some point, I think it was towards the end of the semester, to switch my work OS from Windows to Linux. And I used Ubuntu back then, and I kind of did it for like everything that I did, except for gaming. I had a dual boot then. And it worked fine. So how did it look back then? It looked a little like this, yeah, looks a little like back to the 80s. But it did run nicely, you could configure stuff, you could break it, you could rebuild it. And it worked pretty nicely for my daily job stuff. For studies, that's good. So I kind of got my own experiences and it felt nice. I realized, yeah, I can do everything on Linux, right? It's not as difficult as it sounds. And I think from the third semester on, servers happened. So what does that mean usually? I mean, you bump into something like company needs stuff. You get a headless Debian, you work with SSH remote access, you work with command line interface, you work with config files, right? And in the end, you don't yet understand everything, so it's actually copy-paste everywhere. It's Stack Overflow is your best friend. And you look up stuff that you kind of don't know, you read a little, you understand, you copy-paste, it breaks, you ask your colleagues and fix it again. And in all of it, you learn, right? I already learned with my Ubuntu on my desktop. Now I learned with my Debian here on the servers. And it felt okay. It feels nice. You learn, you're okay. You're good with that. So I think in the fourth semester around here, I decided to get myself some own server. I mean, this is like, I think, the second generation that I got. This is like a Raspberry board. It's actually an Odroid board, but it's an ARM chip too. So at the beginning, it was a little of a bigger board. Then it became smaller. Why did I do that? Yeah, because I have my own hardware. I have full control. The geeky me is so happy about that. You know, I can do whatever I want. And it is not even eating up all my electricity because it is such a small board. I used it for software versioning, SVN, Git. I used it for JDownloader loader to download stuff through the night, right? Because it's cool. I did share stuff with friends, with SFTP, etc., etc. And for all of it, I used Ubuntu again. And I learned. I learned. It felt nice. So Ubuntu, desktop computer, Ubuntu on that server here, some Debian on the server that I used for work. My world was pretty much running on Linux, and it was nice. Yeah, and there's one more thing. I found out that Linux is awesome for others too. I mean, you hear, I found out that it's awesome for them, right? So I found out it's awesome for my parents, and it's awesome for my brother, and for my girlfriend, and for the family of the girlfriend, and for the friends, and for the friends of the friends, right? So my life started looking a little like this. Wherever I went, it looked like this, and some shit breaks here, some stuff breaks there, and you fix it all the time, and it feels awesome, right? It's like playground. This is super exciting, right? And I learned, right? So why did I use Ubuntu for all of that? Because I didn't want to play that type of Guitar Hero on Linux all the time. Linux has some complexity in the beginning. If you don't know what you're dealing with, then it's a little complicated, at least in the beginning. And Ubuntu is simple. I mean, it has some advantages altogether. It has that simplicity in the beginning. It has full repositories. That means there's lots of software that you can pretty much install as it is from the repositories. It has some good documentation, so it's not one of these super rare distros, it's one of the big ones. Whatever you kind of need, you find some documentation for that. And it's pretty easy to install. Like, you put the disk in, you click install, you go through the steps, that's it. It's easy to use and it's easy to maintain, and you can easily modify and configure whatever you want to be different than the standard setup that you get. So the drawbacks, in my perspective, I mean, I didn't know about any of them. In the beginning, there really were none for me. And the point is just over time, these things might change. So all of these points that now have a star, yeah, we're going to see about them in the future, in a couple of minutes actually, because these things, they might really change. And for me, they changed. Also keep in mind that Ubuntu comes pre-configured. So it is a standard setup that you get. So you inherently do these two things in that order. You install your Ubuntu, which is the standard config. And then as a second step, you start modifying stuff. That means changing the configuration, modifying the OS, adding stuff, removing stuff, maybe removing things that start conflicting with what you want to have, etc. So this is kind of like built in this order. And for all of you in here that like tried some tweaks in Linux already, like, you know, you want to change something that is a little different than what the standard configuration is, you will know that. I mean, at some point, pretty much everyone tries a different desktop environment, right? I mean, you start with something. It could be GNOME, it could be KDE, and you want to change the other one. But there is more. I mean, there is XFCE, there is LXDE, and there is so many more. So you install that stuff, you change it, you see, yeah, I can switch that stuff. Maybe something breaks because you, you know, have conflicting software, but it works. Or who tried that? Let's, oh yeah, people shake their heads. Nobody would want to admit it. Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah, when you're used to that. The point is, like, many people tried it and you want to go for the different options. So in the end, it's like, I tried, for example, making my computer look like a Mac. I remember that well. I had some Mac users around me and they were like, what, do you use a Mac? I'm like, no, this is just configured to look like a Mac, but it was obviously faking it pretty well. So I kind of only did it because I wanted to have the button on the left side. And it came with the UI theme. So for that, you have to search for the UI theme, some doc, some icons, etc., etc. But it's possible. You know, you can make it look like this. Maybe this is not the only tweaks that you want to apply. Maybe there is more. So all these people that know that Alt F2 shortcut to run stuff in Linux, many distributions have it. I wanted at some point, I wanted that replaced with something more, you know, sophisticated, something that gives me a little more options. And for me, that became was Rofi. Back then, it was in the repositories, I think in a development version or so, super old, not easy to install. And I kind of did some tweaks and it, you know, I got it to run and it's fine. So I had that in the beginning, you know, a little effort, but it works. Or maybe I wanted to so have something even more, like having a different shell with a better shell, better command history search. So that became Fish for me, the friendly interactive shell Friendly in the Active Shell, I think is the name, and FZF for the search. So back then I remember that Fish was in the repositories in an old version and FZF was not in the repository at all. So I installed it from somewhere else, found out that FZF required a new version of Fish. So I got a new version of Fish first, which I kind of had to, I mean, the point is these tweaks start becoming work, right? But it's worth it. Why? Because it's cool and it's usable. So you do it, because you can. In Windows you can't, in Mac you can't. We are cool, we can do that, so we do it. Right, it's work, yeah, we have to find sources, compile that stuff. There are dependencies missing, yeah, who cares, we're gonna find them. The required version is missing, overwritten of that previous software, a little weird, but you know, Google helps. There's good documentation. There's config files, maybe they're duplicates afterwards because we have different versions. Maybe someone remembers there's the GTK 2 and 3 config file. I always love changing them. They're somewhere, right? But they're used, so, you know, maybe don't break that. Maybe they're overwritten by updates because you changed something, which is nice and neat, and the update and gone. And maybe the versions are not compatible, was my favorite sometimes. Copying the same file to different locations and finding out, yeah, the new version uses a different config file and not a new version crashes. Was super funny. So, but the point is, it's cool and usable. So yeah, we can do it. And we do it. Yeah. You know, for all of this, remind me, Ubuntu is a good reason for that, right? Keep in mind, I'm not ranting about any operating system, specifically not any Linux, and specifically not about Ubuntu. It's an awesome thing. But for what I did, Ubuntu is a good idea, right? Simple. Has full repositories. Stuff is easy to install and config. Right? And it's easy to modify and maintain because good documentation. And it saves me a lot of time by being like this. Right? And this is why I'm here today, because the elephant in the room is, it took me a while to find out that at that point in time, for what I wanted to do, Ubuntu was not the best choice anymore. I emphasize anymore here, right? I did learn lots of things the easy way in the beginning. The point was just that I did stick to that stuff for a very long time. And at some point I did kind of outgrow it because I wanted to modify so many things. And with that knowledge that already kind of like had aggregated up to that point, I would have been able to do much more. People suggested that to me, and I was discarding that for a long time by, I'm really not that good. I'm really not that good. And I cannot just switch to something like Arch Linux or so. So it took me a while to realize that these tiresome problems that I have here now, that they really bothered me. I had the problem with release cycles, software availability and the updates, and that the third point I'm not going to highlight anymore, it's that modifying, removing, adding stuff really made things break a little, so they didn't really work together so well after all the modifications that I did, because I installed and then changed and not the other way around, so to say. It is like, you know, changing something that is not designed to be changed this way. You can do something else here. Quickly highlighting what that means. The first one, the distribution release cycle, point one, is you probably know that these distributions usually have some release cycles. So you might have a new version each 2 years in the long-term support, which I used, or each maybe like 6 months, as with Ubuntu, if you use the regular versions. And these release cycles mean there is going to be lots of new stuff at that point in time. So you get with, at one like go, you get like lots of updates. And specifically if you tune the system a lot, that means specific software versions and, you know, updates here, config files here. These updates, they have a tendency to break lots of stuff, specifically if it's custom designed beforehand. And that's like, ouch. Each 6 months, stuff breaks. I mean, it's lots of changes. So I had sometimes had a situation, I reboot, everything works up to that point, and it doesn't even start anymore because so many things are broken, and then I have to backtrack and find what actually did break. It's, you know, the system itself would have been fine, but with the changes that I did, things don't work together anymore. And that was kind of like my takeaway. So my solution for this was, I really don't want to spend so much time on fixing stuff all the 2 years and I really mess up my system anyway by adding all that software, files, configs, you know, and like, we're gonna see that in a minute. So I said, I'm taking the chance on a clean install each 2 years because this is how it's intended to be, right? Clean system, nice, runs quick. In 2 years, I have to do the same thing, but it's good. See, I mean, I still did save my system from being replaced with something else, but yeah, it got tiresome. And the second thing is that at some point I realized that people were actually right when they pointed out that the software that I had in the repositories was either some things that I needed were not there because they were just really not available, or they were there but really outdated. Keep in mind that if you have a 2-year support, usually people add stuff and then they try to keep it more or less the same for 2 years. I mean, a little bit of that stuff changes, but it's mostly the same package that you get. So I bumped into lots of situations where I was like, how can I do that with that software, right? You Google for it, you see, hey, this is possible. And then you check it out, that doesn't exist with my software here. Why? Yeah, because the software version that you have is like more than a year old. So it is already there, it's documented that it works this way and you don't have it. Or you bump into a bug, like how can I work around that bug? You find out, hey, that's fixed like a long time ago, more than a year, not in my repositories, right? So it's also like the third point here is that other software, for example, needs something in a higher version than you have it. It's not in your repositories, but you still need it. Like in my FZF scenario, I needed the new version of Fish. I had to add that by hand. What does it mean when I say add it by hand? It means these things don't work in the standard configuration, but you know, we're on Linux. We can do that, right? Because we can change stuff. So we're gonna do it, and that means manually. And here is where the problems start, right? Because it means now we're gonna look into things where we say, I need that thing in a higher version. It's not in the repositories. So I look for custom repositories. I need to search for them. I need to read. I need to trust those guys to do the right things, that there is no malware in it, obviously. I need to edit. I need to install stuff. Sometimes there is conflicts. These repositories outdate too, right? Because they're also maintained by humans only, right? At some point, they maybe drop that support. By doing so, if it's not done with the package management or that stuff is not well configured, you start losing files in your file system. So they're there. Nobody knows that they're there. Leads to funny conflicts. Some dependencies start being missing. Some, you know, configs files start being like shown up twice or three times or so. And in the long run, things break a lot. So for me, the finding was not that doing this is problematic. For me, it was keeping it running is problematic. Getting it running is cool. Keeping it running is taking my time. Right? I mean, I need to continuously invest time to keep it running the more of these things I do. And this was costing me many nerves and much time. And I started realizing that at some point. My personal favorite is this one. I have like 3 config files of the same software somewhere in different places. And all that I know is that they're most likely, I don't know, right? Most likely for different versions of it. And the point is no one knows. I mean, you could probably look it up. They're all likely needed somewhere. And then you end up in like, I want to change something because, you know, I want to fine-tune it. What do you do? Do you just randomly try one? Do you apply it to all? I mean, you don't know if they all have the same syntax, if they support the same options, right? And in the end, you change all of them and nothing happens. Why? Because there is a fourth config file somewhere that you don't know about, which is the one that is actually used. And it's super cool if you have external repositories and they ship their own config files. So awesome. I mean, like, I was not amused about that, but it took me a while to realize that. So, you know, this is kind of natural. It works as long as you don't fine tune everything. And I mean, you know, you learn. I still learned back then. So what I kind of found out over these years, which I want to give you as an experience here, like maybe that you can save yourself from doing that for such so long. Managing all of this felt a little like doing that, right? And if you kind of break something in it, then it feels like rewiring and ordering these nicely distinguishable cables in that super orderly pile of cables. Because your update just rewired randomly one of these cables somewhere. And this is what I did a lot. And I mean, you know, it's fun if you don't do it all the time. And you know what the best about it is? Do you remember the many computers that I dealt with? You know, that's so exciting. They sometimes wanted to have the same tweaks as I had, because they are super nice and neat. So I ended up doing this for them. And then I started realizing that some of these things don't work for me. Because if you do them so often, then you see like, this is really a little weird. Maybe these people are right that tell me that I could try something else for myself, right? So the one takeaway of all of this was the main drawbacks that I found over all these years. The more that I want or need for myself, the more time I need to continuously, and the emphasis on continuously, invest to keep my system running. Getting it there is not a big thing, but keeping it running this way, that is costing me time and nerves. Setting it up like each two years again, for example. And then I decided, yeah, honestly, these people are right. This is actually far from optimal. And I would want to try to change something about this. And this is like my story that I had over these years. And my question would now be, does that feel familiar? A little. My question maybe to the audience would now be, who has not yet seen a single of these issues yourself? Would you quick mind to raise your hands? I kind of doubt that nobody actually raises their hand. Like, okay, let's do it the other way around. Who has seen at least one of these issues at some point yourself here? Could you please raise the hand? I'm amazed. Okay, so this is many people. Then my takeaway, or like my message to you would be the following. You might actually be right here today. Right? Because it could be that Arch Linux turns out to be the solution to these problems. Right? If you bumped into these problems already, it means that you have you have aggregated some knowledge about Linux already, and you would be able to use a distribution that would be a little more difficult, like Arch Linux is. Okay, now to part two. We are going to do a break somewhere in the middle, but not yet. So now to Arch Linux. This is like the lots of superfluous details because, as I said before, it's all in the Arch documentation. And it's there in plain English. It's easy to find, it's easy to read and to understand for real. I'm not going to put any documentation onto my slides today, so you're not going to see anything. But I'm going to point out multiple times that these things that I say would be there in plain English. So you could really check out all these details yourself. The slides are online, as I said, so like all of these links you can click. You get to the general documentation, you get to the individual details of certain steps that I'm going to point out. So why Arch? Some general info about it. Arch is, like you know, in my very sloppy saying, the no problemo man, it just works distro for pros. And what do I mean by that? Pros is the wrong term. You don't need to be a professional or super experienced in Linux. However, it demands a little from you. We're going to see that in a moment, right? And no problemo, it just works means once it is running, you are probably not going to have these issues and problems that we talked about beforehand. The principles behind Arch are it's a lightweight Linux that tries to keep it very simple, so like KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid, and it's pretty minimalistic, so it switches that thing around. It is not like install in a standard way and then change, but it's more like only have the basis and then add these things that you really need, right? Less stuff that can break in the end. That's how I would say it. So, connecting to what we had before, these problems that I pointed out for what I personally didn't like in my previous Linux experience. The key arguments for using something like Arch here would be, you have always up-to-date software. You never run out of these like sources for up-to-date software. There is a rolling release principle in Arch, so that means you don't have these dist upgrades that change so many things. Like each 6 months or each 2 years, there is no need for a reinstall in that stuff. You have huge repositories. And you have awesome package management. We're going to see this in detail. And once that stuff is running, it is more or less zero maintenance. So yeah, you have to do maintenance. And you have to do it pretty often. But it is pretty much zero effort. Because it is a super small thing that you need to do. Arch is running for super many years without problems usually. And in all of it, your system is exactly the way you need it. So no superfluous stuff. It's exactly what you want. If you're sitting in these rows now and think, I have a rough idea of what I would want my Linux to be, that means, you know, which desktop environment, which, you know, software you use, this is what Arch needs from you. This is the knowledge that Arch needs. If you don't have any idea about that, it might be too early for Arch. If you have an idea about that, it might be cool. In the end, all of these points will save you lots of time and nerves, but lots of time. Because you invest way less time in on a daily basis, in a continuous manner. So now this looks awesome, right? The question is, what does it demand in return? Right? Yeah, Arch Linux demands something. It demands more or less two things. Some operating system understanding, and it will teach you for it. It's not black magic. It's also only cooking with water, so to say. And it requires some manual setup, and it again will teach you for it. It's again not black magic. It's all in the manual. This is, I think, the only slide where I didn't link the manual, by the way. why do I say some? Because it is not as much as you would probably guess it would be. In these 4 points, it requires just some Linux system knowledge. That means a rough idea of how the system works like, where you find certain things. If you had a Linux class, you most likely have that. Some command line usage, that means don't be afraid of using that terminal window that you have to type something in. That is definitely required. And the third point is changing the config files of the system, because pretty much everything in Arch is configured through config files. You don't do that through UI, because the UI really differs depending on what you want to have. And the fourth point is kind of like the elephant in the room. It is, with Arch, you at some point need to go through that manual installation process. This is what most people will be afraid of. It is the elephant in the room also in the learning effect. Once you did that, you understand your system like you did not do before. And this is exactly what's going to save you so much time in the end. So, the question that I hear very often is, why the hell is this easy? And the answer is simple. It is RTFM, because it really works with Arch, right? As I said before, has an immense documentation, it's easy to read, and it's actually that good that it's likely the best one out there, and other distros frequently link to the Arch distro because it's hard to come up with something that concise and easy to understand and that, you know, like covering all the details that you really need, so that they just don't do it themselves, they link to the Arch distro, they link to the Arch documentation. My recommendation for the Arch documentation would be, whatever you do there, if you don't know the details yourself, stick to it, try it out, stick to it, and you will save yourself much time and nerves, and you will learn much. Whenever there is something in the documentation that you don't know about, there is likely a link that actually says, you need to do this and that, and you don't know what this is, then click on that link and read it and execute and do stuff as it is described there. And there is also that rule of thumb, you're going to hear that multiple times today. If something is not in a documentation, then there is a good chance that you actually don't need it. Arch Linux users, they kind of do pretty much everything. If it's not in the documentation, then it could be that you're trying to solve the wrong problem, or you're maybe trying to use the wrong tool for the right job. So it could be that there is a better solution for what you want to do, which is in the documentation, right? Okay. There is a couple of infos that I want to give you that are not on the core of Arch yet, but which maybe are good that you know about. So frequently asked questions sometimes cover Arch or some of these other versions like Manjaro or Antergos or dot dot dot, because there are more than that. Arch, in a nutshell, is the bare, the raw version, which is like the big learning effect. Manjaro, for example, delays software updates. So without having said what that exactly is, the rolling release, just saying for now, this kind of defeats the purpose of a rolling release system. And Arch and Manjaro to some extent ship some pre-installed software, which means in the end uninstalling stuff that you don't need. This is kind of like a discussion where you can really have different opinions on. So I'm just pointing out what I would say my personal opinion is and the opinion that of the people that I got recommendations from myself. And there is more options here. You can read up like on Reddit. There is super many discussions about the details. My recommendation for Arch, Manjaro, Antergos, etc. would be work through the raw Arch installation. Be brave, try it, fail. That's part of the learning. Retry, which is why it's in bold. If you don't retry, you're not gonna get to Arch, right? I bet that you're gonna fail once. It's not gonna take you much time, but you're gonna fail. And you're gonna be like, oh yeah, I should have read the manual. I did it myself, twice. You learn, and in the end, you win so much by doing exactly that for your own future. I've asked this question myself, what should I use? And the recommendation that I got from people that used Arch was stick to the raw Arch and have that learning effect. And this is what I recommend to you today. So I kind of agree, after having done myself, I agree fully with that recommendation. And another thing, there is an on-purpose limitation with Arch. It is designed for the x86 architecture, 64-bit version of it, and there is no other support. That means technically 32-bit processors are not supported, ARM chips are not supported, etc. That means phones, tabs, IoT devices which have these chips, they are not supported. However, there are ports of Arch. For example, archlinuxarm.org has a port for 32-bit ARM processors, so you can use it there. And the other on-purpose limitation is, it is a design decision that updates are done by hand. That means Arch is for systems with active user interaction. Think about it, this means that most of the servers that you would want to have lying around, which are not touched daily, they are not inherently, Arch is not designed inherently to run on these systems, right? I mean, it would be possible, you just need to log in and do updates there yourself. It works. But it might not be the best thing to do so. The same with many of these IoT devices that we have lying around. So from the conceptual point of view, Arch is designed with your laptops and your workstations in mind, and not the servers and not these, you know, phones, etc. Okay. With a little more, then we're gonna do a break. Guys, let's get going. Arch is awesome. We want to install it. How? Any ideas? Yeah! Finally! RTFM, right? If you have zero idea what you do, you go to wiki.archlinux.org and there is a search field. And it's neat. And it gives you result in plain English that you can read and work with. So if you do that, I mean, you can also go to Google. It's going to give you the Arch installation guide. So how does installation, the installation work? There is a step-by-step guide that my recommendation is, guys, stick to it. Stick to the details, right? Don't simply skip stuff if you don't understand it. There is a link that you click on and that says, this is done for that reason and this is how you do it. If you skip it, I mean, it might be maybe cool because you retry the whole thing and you learn more if you do it multiple times. right? Because it's not going to work this way. I found, as I said, out about that in the beginning twice, because I like tried to be clever, and in the end I did read the manual, and then it did work. So just to kind of like remove that fear a little, I have two slides about the Arch installation in a nutshell. These are the detailed steps that you need to do without the commands, and I'm just quickly gonna say a sentence to each. The first one is you need a bootable device and you need to boot from it. Everyone who has ever installed an operating system somewhere has done that. You need to set your keyboard layout. This is one command. You can copy it from the manual. You need to verify your boot mode. This is, yeah, you guessed it, one command. And you can copy it from the manual. You need to connect to the internet. That might be multiple or zero, depending on your exact setup. You update the system clock. Same thing again. One command, copying. You need to partition your disk. This is a little more, like couple commands, because you need to probably use one command per partition. Actually, it's one command that you execute, and then you do all these selections and say, I want to have the partition from here to there, etc. Then you need to format these partitions. One command for each partition. You can also copy that. You need to mount these partitions. Same thing again. You want to configure the Arch mirrors, which is usually only ordering entries in one list, so it's one file they need to touch, and then you're actually already ready to install the base Arch system. This is one command. This command installs the base Arch system on that machine. So this is really a fetching and copying process that runs for a while. All of these steps are in the manual in details, including the exact commands that you need to do. Right? This is where you shouldn't just simply skip stuff, even if you don't yet know what it's for. The second thing is, we're not yet done, but we already have a bare Arch system there, is we create an fstep file so that we can boot into that the partitions are usable, I mean. And that is again one command. Then we change root into the installed Arch system, which is again one command. We configure the time zone, localization, and hostname, which is three commands in total. We set the root password for the root user, one command. And then we install and configure the bootloader. This is more commands that really depends on what bootloader you would want to use. Who uses Grub here, by the way? Yeah, okay, pretty many. Who uses something else than Grub? Yeah, do you know by heart what you use? Yeah, okay. There is, yeah. I mean, I just want to point out, for these people, for all of you who want to try Arch, Grub is not necessarily the best option, just that you know. It's in the manual. If you get to the point and it says there is like that one option that we recommend, and there is Grub and the others as well, stick to the recommendation. It's way easier. I found out myself, it's like, you know, Grub works, right? It's doing its job pretty nicely. But there is one that integrates with systemd, I don't know the name, which is your init process, so it's like way better connected. Just that you know, that the recommended version is the one that I ended up using in the end. Just wanted to quickly point it out. It saves you lots of things. Grub maybe has 20 commands or so, the other one, 3 or 4, I don't know, like super small amount. Yeah, guys, and then we are done. We exit the change root, one command, unmount the partitions, as many commands as we have partitions, and then we reboot into our freshly installed Arch Linux. Yes! So, question. Why do we have these things in individual steps if we need to do them all the time anyway? Because guys who really know what they do could change any of these. It's not like there is an invisible install process that does all of that automatically. Because it's individual steps, everyone can slip in other things. That means specific partition types, operating system modifications, encrypted disks, all of this. This is kind of something that you can integrate at every point there. It's again in the manual. It's just something that is said as like, this is optional. And then you have all the things that guys who really know what they do can do at any point in time. Okay, so now we are done. Arch Linux is installed. So when you boot, what happens? I mean, the first thing is you realize, yeah, we did it, right? This is a real screenshot fail. This is a picture of a screen of a laptop, because it's really difficult to do a screenshot of a bootloader. That's why I ended up taking pictures. So this says we have Arch Linux and you can boot it. So when you kind of have booted, this is your Arch Linux, right? I mean, you have a nice login. That's your real TTY. So there is no graphical user interface. You log in. Actually, I had to change that because I really, you know, didn't just want to set up any Arch system myself for that presentation. So there is no root. There is no other user than root. So actually, at the first login, you log in with your root user. It's the only one that is there. But there is lots of stuff that is already there. So we have all the partitions that we created before. This is from an Arch system that is in use for a while. So there is some file system usage, which is definitely not going to be as high with your new Arch that you have installed. And there is also like your, we're going to see that later, your system control command, which in the status shows you there is some stuff running, right? But not much. I mean, this is a system that is running without any graphical user interface at the moment. So actually, your freshly installed Arch would have less than these things running. Arch really doesn't start many things automatically if it's raw and bare. So, you know, your Arch is running. You have a bootable Linux file system, mounted partitions, your systemd init process is running. You have a shell, that's the one that you got dropped into. You have a root user, you have your basic command line programs, like, you know, print working directory, ls, and all that stuff. And you have all these things that Arch requires because it's an Arch Linux, like Pacman, etc. But there is lots of stuff not there, right? I mean, you don't have any other user than root. You don't have a sudo command, a network manager, a graphical user interface, like not even an X server. You don't have a login manager, window manager, desktop environment, and no user programs at all at the moment. So we're gonna change that. We can either do a break now and change it after the break, then you see how we do that. Or we can go on a couple of slides and do the break later on. It's your choice. People say break, I guess, right? Nah? Okay, you want to go on? That's good, right? Ah, yes. So, at that point, I would actually want you to hold for a moment and recap one thing. At this point, your system is already running. That means your Linux itself is there. Your Linux doesn't need more than this. This is what is required by design, so to say. Everything else from now on is technically already optional. You don't need to do any of this, though it is very likely and highly recommended that you do it. But now these things start differing. Each one might do something else here. Some people might not need any other user than a root user. I really don't recommend that, but it is inherently possible. Okay? Some people don't need a graphical user interface. Okay, just that you know, from here on it's optional. Okay, having said that, yeah, you miss lots of stuff. I mean, I said it once, I said again, you miss lots of stuff. So what do we do about it? We want to fix that. Yeah? Could anyone suggest anything for me? Guys. Oh, yeah, right. So, same thing again, right? If you go through the installation steps at the very bottom, there is something that says installation guide hashtag post installation. So they say, yeah, you made it, right? You can boot into your Arch. You most likely want to do that post installation steps. So they even point that out very clearly. And there is a link that, I mean, when you read that, it mostly leads to that link that says the general recommendations that you want to do to any Linux, yeah, Arch Linux is pretty good, but any Linux. And the general recommendation in a nutshell here is you want to add a non-root user which is pretty quickly done. You want to install sudo and configure it. You want, for example, if you have an Intel CPU, you want to have Intel microcode. For all of you who don't know what that is, Intel CPUs have some bugs and your operating system works around them. So this is like, you know, this is a feature by usage, bug by design, but feature by how we use it. So you want to install that stuff. Most people want to use a graphical user interface, so you will install an X server or a Wayland server, because these are going to be your display servers. You might want to install then a desktop environment like, you know, GNOME, KDE, XFCE, etc. And or, really depending on your setup, a display manager like GDM, LDM, and or a window manager like i3, and many more. So just to point out that these things, they're optional, right? I mean, for example, I myself, I have an X server running. I have no desktop environment, no display manager. I just have a window manager. Why? Because I don't need that other stuff. I don't require it in my case. That really depends. So there is no point, bullet point list of things that you need to do. If you say, I want to have, I don't know, GNOME, then you go to the manual, check out what Arch says for GNOME, follow these steps, and you're gonna have GNOME like this. That's it. Other things that you want to do usually, it's all in that long list, right? So it's just things that I would point out so that you see they're neither difficult nor like black magic. You might want to install some networking or network manager, like, you know, a network manager or WICD or a conman. If it's a laptop, you want maybe want to have some power management for it enabled. You might want to have some sound, like ALSA, Pulse Audio, etc. Keep in mind, this might not apply to servers. You don't need that stuff at all. You might want to have some codecs to be able to play your video and audio files. If you have a gaming keyboard or a laptop, you might want to configure these special buttons there. And you might also want to configure some printing or like some fonts of your UI, depending on which exact UI you have, or some UI resizing, that means making everything look super nice and, you know, sub-pixel, anti-aliasing, etc., all of these magic things that as a command line user I really don't know about at all. So you just look it up in the manual. Okay. So once Arch is configured, we have installed it, it's running, we have configured it because we did these steps, we have networking, etc. Only this one thing remains: system maintenance. And that inherently is these two things. The one is the really important one. You want to do regular updates of your system by running this command. There is going to be more details about this in a moment. And the second one is, occasionally you might want to look at the mirrors that you get that software from and order these things in that file. Both things are described here, like they're in the manual. As usual, they have an own section on that explains what exactly it is that you should do. And the point is, besides that stuff, you inherently don't really need to do anything at all anymore. There is an exception. We're going to see that some updates might require manual intervention, but this is rarely the case. Besides that, if you keep a system like this and kind of maintain it like this, this is going to run for many years. No dist upgrades anymore, no reinstallations anymore. Okay, and now I would say we do a break, because we have these 4 points left. We're going to look at them after the break. So recommendation would be 10 minutes maybe. Okay, so would be cool if you could be back in about 10 minutes for continuing. Thanks.